Welcome aboard Candid Cockpit. This is the podcast that puts you at the pointy end of the airplane with two veteran airline captains. We'll offer insight into the pilot brain, have some fun, and promise not to get too techie. Each weekly episode has a segment that provides inside information on what's really going on behind the cockpit door, and we'll discuss some industry current topics that might affect your travels. Your two pilots and co-hosts are Les Aben and Mike Strauss. Les has over four decades and over 25,000 hours of experience flying airplanes. The Boeing 727, 757, 767, and the 777 were all part of Les's repertoire before he retired. He was also a Czech airman. Additionally, Les still has the good fortune to be a 21-year contributing editor for Flying Magazine. He has been an on-air analyst and op-ed contributor for CNN, in addition to MSNBC and NBC, among others. And finally, Les is the author of Paper Wings, a mystery suspense whodunit thriller. Mike is a current A320 captain and Czech airman for a major airline with over 17,000 hours of flight time. In addition to his airline experience, Mike has a diverse general aviation background as an airplane salesman and a corporate pilot flying celebrities and VIPs. If you haven't done so already, please listen to the Welcome Aboard introductory episode. Don't get on an airplane until you've listened to Candid Cockpit.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for coming to this week's episode of Candid Cockpit. On this takeoff segment, we're going to discuss raising the pilot retirement age from 65 to 67. Mm-hmm. Is it a safe thing to do? We'll talk about that.
Could be. Do you think it'll help the pilot shortage is another question
that's the big issue that it's being brought up. Yeah. Exactly.
And for the crew segment, tilt your seat back and prep for a fun discussion on our early beginnings as pilots. Pretty much how we got to be pilots and why we're here.
And then finally for the landing segments, we'll give you some insight into landing a large jet and in some cases landing a large jet badly.
Or well. I'm going to go with well.
Okay.
So we have a favor to ask as we carry on here. Invite your friends to listen to Candid Cockpit Podcast.
And then secondly, send us an email. Let us know if there's a topic you would like discussed. And if we discuss it on air, we'll put your name on air with your permission.
Of course. And finally, next time you're on an airplane, say hello to your pilots and tell them about the Candid Cockpit and see if they listen to it. Will a proposal to raise the mandatory airline pilot retirement age to 67 create more problems, or will it help solve the pilot shortage issue?
So let's talk about something that the public is probably more concerned about, is there a safety issue with having older pilots in a cockpit?
Some might argue age, but then I think some might argue experience.
I think pilots want to, or passengers want to see pilots with a little bit of gray hair, at least some.
I've been accused of, you're the captain, where's your gray hair?
Right.
So yeah,
they
do.
So that doesn't necessarily equate to health necessarily.
No.
It does equate to experience. But let's stay on the medical topic. As we get older, we all, things just don't work as well, right?
Correct.
Now, most pilots that get hired by the airline are screened for their medical history and for their medical health.
And we have to sustain a medical certificate.
Correct. So we are generally above average as far as health is concerned with the rest of the public.
Correct.
Right. But there are things, cardiac issues do start to arise as we get older. And then there are other things. It's simple things like knees, mm-hmm. start to fall apart.
Shoulders.
So, you know, that kind of thing starts to get worse as we get older. There was a discussion on one of the network channels, one of the financial network channels, with Scott Kirby, the CEO of United Airlines. And he said 36% of his 64-year-old pilots were either on short-term medical leave or long-term medical leave, which means they're 1 year away from retirement.
Right.
And why is that?
Partly could be because they want to get stuff fixed while they still have insurance.
Yeah. And it, you know, and it's understandable because they have better insurance. At 65, you go on Medicare. I mean, there are some folks that will have their own private insurance, but generally speaking, it's better insurance with the airline.
Agreed.
Right.
Yeah. And so you do. You want to get things fixed before you have to retire. So, yeah, really, is it 65 or is it 64? People just start punching out to get these items fixed, takes them out of the cockpit for that last year, so to speak.
And the other part of it is that the public might be concerned with, and some of our legislatures might be concerned with, is more of the mental acuity aspect of it.
You could, but I still think in your mid-60s, you're pretty sharp.
And I would say the majority of us, of course, are.
Right.
And there was some suggestion of a mental acuity test that could be presented. But at the end of the day, what do we do every recurrent training?
We study when we practice for the emergencies that we rarely encounter. So it keeps us sharp for that very reason.
Right.
You know, if you think about it, when you go to your aviation medical examiner and he gives you your biannual medical, right, he's probably playing some, you know, psych games with you to see just how acute you are to what's going on in your surroundings. You know, it's not just, you know, stick your tongue out and breathe, you know, and say, ah. They're kind of playing some games or asking questions, seeing how things are going. They're kind of checking you as you sit in that office and converse with them.
I'm just trying to figure out how I got through the medical then.
It's the $100 bills you keep handing the guy.
Well, that's despite,
yeah.
But I think that sort of addresses the medical. And I think the big concern is, hey, you have two pilots up there and one has a serious medical issue where he's incapacitated.
Right.
You know, that's kind of seems like a threat and a scare to our passengers. But at the end of the day, that rarely happens.
Very.
And the other pilot up there is going to be able to handle the situation.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the training, too.
Exactly.
You know, yeah, we go through situations where the other pilot during your training just kind of goes incapacitated, whether it's just, you know, slumps over or just doesn't pay attention. And the pilot that is now flying must take up that slack and recognize, A, what's happening and continue to carry on to a safe outcome.
Our airline actually had a DC-10 land in Newark with a captain that became incapacitated and very unfortunately had a cardiac arrest. And a co-pilot recognized that he was having problems,
right,
and was able to get control of the airplane very quickly because they were on short final.
Oh, when that is bad timing.
Yeah, real bad timing.
But again, like I said, that's part of the training is we train for these things. We train for the, this is never going to happen, although it might happen.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right,
and that's what, and then, and like I said previously, that keeps us sharp as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've sort of answered the medical questions with, right, reference to the raising the retirement age from 65 to 67. Medically, I don't think we're falling into issues. But so where are the issues? And I think what we have to go to is what is happening globally.
Right.
And where we're what we're talking about at this point is that with International Civil Aviation Organization rules, ICAO as we call them, age 65 is the limit for majority of
the countries throughout the world.
Australia does have an exception to that, but those pilots can fly over 65, but they have to stay domestic in their country.
Okay.
So here in the United States, 65 is maximum. So if we have pilots that are that age, that are in international flying, and guess what?
They're going to a country that doesn't allow over 65.
Because when we fly
to another country, we're now flying under their rules.
Correct. Or ICAO rules.
ICAO rules, right.
So at the end of the day, we may not be able to fly to that particular country because of the ICAO rules of not being able to fly over age 65. And age 65 pilots, for the most part, are the senior pilots, and they're flying
big equipment.
Big equipment. Yep. And the airlines as well are integrating international flying with domestic flying on the same trip that you report.
Right. Right. Yeah. So you go to Australia one day, come home from there a couple of days later, now you're in Los Angeles or New York or someplace like that.
So what they would have to do is to parse out a schedule for the over 65-year-old. And how do you do that when we have the old standard seniority-based system?
Seniority rules everything. And by doing that, you're usurping it dramatically. Or you could be.
Well, you're not being fair to the junior people. Why does the senior guy, just because he's over age 65, get a domestic schedule in that particular airplane?
Right.
And most of the time, you know, we're talking wide-body aircraft, right?
And back to seniority, you know, when we get to that level of seniority and we are flying the wide-body, we want to go international.
Right.
International trips pay more because they're typically longer. You also get to see parts of the world that maybe you haven't seen yet that you've been waiting your entire airline career to get
and
see.
Yep.
So, yeah, it is all about seniority. So bigger, farther, faster is usually going to be, hate to say it, the older pilot.
Right, right. And it's and really, it's compensation.
It's about the almighty dollar.
Well, that's what drives it. The bigger the airplane, the bigger the paycheck, essentially.
Right.
So parsing that out would be difficult. The other, if you ask the airline to pay the same rate if that pilot was flying those trips, they're going to be very reluctant to do that.
Exactly.
That wouldn't be a situation the airline would be willing to compensate for. The other part is, you know, would a senior pilot that's been flying an airplane like I flew a 777 want to go back and make a bunch of landings flying a 737
right.
or A320, whatever narrow body airplane is, if they were to go back or were forced to go back, what would that do? Well, that would bottleneck the training.
Now they've got to go to a different airplane.
They've got to
put someone else in the other airplane to fill his seat or that pilot's seat, not his or her seat.
Yeah, because they're transitioning.
And there's already enough of a bottleneck in training as it is.
And the new hire pilots are starting their training.
Yeah.
So one is going to affect the other. And it's just it just becomes a very difficult situation. Even 2 years.
Makes a big difference.
I don't even think it'd be a Band-Aid to help the pilot shortage.
I really don't think it's going to help the pilot shortage because the biggest issue, I mean, I guess in a very long stretched out rubber band, maybe, but you really need to be focusing on getting younger pilots into the airlines.
Right.
So, and that's a whole other program. You know, we talk about ab initio, something like that. That's another topic.
Starting from zero time.
Right? Yeah. So, you know, again, extending 2 years, really all you're doing is helping the older guys that don't want to quit flying to keep flying.
I think it's making the problem absolutely worse. And we're not solving, you know, the experience problem that we'll be discussing. And at the end of the day, you know, you've got to move ahead with the idea that older pilots are just going to retire.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
That's the only way to do it. And age 67, by the way, you kind of know Mike and I, how we feel about it. The bill is called Let Experience Fly. If you have any say in it, say no.
Yeah, no,
as far as we're concerned.
I would agree.
Yeah.
You know, and I look at it, you know, I'm coming up, I'm 60, so I've only got 4 years, 9 months, and 6 days to go. But I also don't want to, because I still want to be young enough to retire and enjoy the things that I still do,
right.
You know, that require physical activity and mental acuity and those things that we've discussed. And yeah, a couple extra years, I don't think it's going to make a difference.
It was an arbitrary age to begin with.
Yeah, 60.
Age 60 was an arbitrary.
Yeah, someone just picked a number and said, this is it. Now, granted, back when that number was chosen, the average life expectancy was a bit lower than it is now.
True, but the reasoning behind that was actually the CEO of the airline I flew for, American Airlines, said that he was concerned that the older pilots that were flying propeller-driven aircraft,
right.
Sophisticated propeller-driven
aircraft,
weren't going to be able to transition to the jet age.
The technology of the jet age.
The technology of the jet age, which was proven totally wrong. But But it stuck.
It's I think it's harder to fly that than a 727.
Yeah, for those of you that are just listening, it's Mike is pointing at a Lockheed Electra that was part of my 6-year-old life. But anyhow, true. But I think I just say let's just say no. And let experienced pilots fly.
Agreed.
So let's move on to our cruise segment. And our cruise segment is kind of fun for both of us. We both talked about it before, probably over beers. But let's tell our listening public about our how we began flying and where we got the experience to get to the airline.
To where we are now.
To where we are now.
Well, not just the experience to get here, but how you got here. Because we have two very different stories. You know, mine is... blind squirrel nut theory almost. It was never on my radar to become an airline pilot. You took a more common path to get here. You had it in your brain from age, well, I'm going to use the age, six.
Six, yeah.
To be an airline pilot. You chose your airline. I just chose to fly because I got tired of driving to Mexico to go surfing.
All right, tell the beer story. Tell the story.
So going to school in San Diego on weekends, me and my buddies, we'd usually cruise down into Mexico to go surfing and, you know, drink beer under 21 because it's legal in Mexico. And there was a place called Scorpion Bay, great right point, about 2/3 of the way down the peninsula. And one day this guy in a Cessna 180 lands his airplane on the beach, pulls a surfboard out. And I'm out in the lineup and I'm watching this and I just get this kind of sideways dog eyes look and thought, that guy's class genius. And that was it. I went home and, I mean, in college, started learning how to fly, ran out of money very quickly, carried on through college, always had an interest in airplanes, carried on through college, got into a career, and then one day said, I need to get into aviation. And I didn't plan on being an airline pilot. I just wanted to get into aviation. Became a flight school manager. That led to, I took my automotive industry knowledge and took that to an aircraft manufacturer. That led me to getting involved with one of our customers in their off-road race team. They said, we want to buy a real airplane, a small jet, and have you manage and fly it. And I said, well, I don't fly those. And they go, well, what do you have to do? I got to go to school. Go to school. So I went to school. That led to a bigger jet. And that led me, got me pretty deep into the corporate world of flying. And then I decided, a few years, it was really fun. I was a young man at the time, younger. And then I decided, you know, I think I'd like a schedule. And the only way to get a true schedule in aviation is own your own airplane, fly it when you want, or be an airline pilot. And so I chose the airline route. And it was, again, not a common route to get to where I am. But I'm here, and I wouldn't have wanted to do anything different. I love the way I got here. Would I have liked to have done it the way you and a lot of my colleagues did? Sure. But then I might have missed out on some experiences in life that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, and it's funny that you say that because if I had any regrets, which I really don't, it was not stopping along the way and smelling the roses. You know, you and I discuss about working on our own airplanes. Well, I wish that I had spent enough time that I could have got my airframe and power plant license.
Yeah.
You know? So, but for me, we're both civilians, so we don't have military background. So in a way, we had similar paths, you know, kind of working through the school of hard knocks as far as that's concerned. But for me, you know, I got that certificate that when I was 6 years old, and it was an inspiration for me. It was, you know, I could appear for an interview 20 years from that date.
Would it be fun if we did that today to pilots, these young kids that come on board?
It would. Yeah. It really would. It would be very inspiring. My parents thought I would get over it, and I never did. And I didn't. I showed up on, you know, 20 years from that date at the, I told them I was coming and
right.
We had people on furlough. And in furlough in airline terms means that you're not fired, you're just laid off essentially. So so I showed up. But before I got to that point, what I had done was I started working for flight time. Sweeping hangar floors for flight time.
And that's, you needed to do that because flying, learning to fly is not inexpensive.
No.
And especially since we did take the civilian route, This is how you do it.
Exactly. And I literally broke a piggy bank when I had to actually pay for my lessons. And, you know, from there, I soloed before I could drive the car. And, you know, at 17, I got my private license. And then I worked my way around looking for aviation schools. Mostly, I started with Air Force ROTC. And then, you know, I found my alma mater, which they would love for me to mention, Purdue University.
Please do.
Yeah. And from Purdue University, you know, it was a four-year program with other academics involved. And I learned how to interview because I didn't get into the program right away. So my freshman year, I would literally take my bike from campus out to the airport to the dean of the school.
Right, of the flight school.
Of the flight school of aviation and say, I would like my opportunity to fly here at Purdue University. And he got so tired of me. I'm sure it had nothing to do with academics.
Finally just said, all right.
Yeah. It's enough.
That's, if you don't ask, you don't get. So I've lived by that theory. So yeah, it works.
It taught me a lot of perseverance.
Yeah.
And so.
Which you need as an airline pilot.
You do.
You really do.
You do. It's just not handed to you.
No.
I mean, it's a little easier than what it was when you and I tried.
Yeah.
You know, to climb the ladder. But anyhow, when I got to that point, I got through 4 years of school. How, I don't know. I don't know, but I managed to.
$100 bills.
Whatever it took. So I became a flight instructor while I was at school, and then I would teach when I came home to my hometown, and I actually taught Air Force ROTC students that were learning to fly initially at Purdue University. And then after that, I decided I'm going to go out and find a commuter airline that I can work for. And the first one I stopped at was Chautauqua Airlines,
right,
in Jamestown, New York. And they said, okay, you're hired.
Yeah.
You're hired.
No, and that's, again, you went knocking on doors. Otherwise, if you hadn't learned that perseverance in your first year of college at Purdue, you might not have had that wherewithal to go knock on doors like that.
And I had very limited experience, very
right,
little time. But that's how it worked back then. And I sat in the right seat of a Beech 99 and ended up even getting furloughed from this little airline, this little commuter airline, where they were called Allegheny Commuters at the time. Mm-hmm. And then I transferred up to South Jersey, became a co-pilot there, and flew back and forth between Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Atlantic City, Newark, all those places. And then I became a captain on the airplane at 23 years old, which was the minimum requirement.
I was going to say minimum requirement for your ATP, your airline transport pilot certificate, which is required to be a captain at an airline.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I remember my paycheck as a captain for an airline was the gross salary, was $1,208
for the year, for the month. Sorry.
For the month. That was gross salary. And my father used to say, you know what? I know you put your name up on the bulkhead when you get into the airplane. Why don't you put your salary up there and see how many people climb on aboard?
Or they might give you some tips. Feel bad for you.
Well, I got a lot of those.
A friend of mine, same thing. He worked for Transstates, flying a Jetstream in the first couple of years. He rode his bike to the airport because he couldn't afford a car.
Yeah.
Now, it's a completely different story now.
Correct. People can actually make a living at it now. But I was pretty much below the food stamp wage.
Yeah.
At that particular, at least as a co-pilot.
The welfare line.
Yeah, welfare line. But, you know, that progressed into a freight carrier that at the time contracted with UPS before they had their actual fleet. And I flew, went right to a 727. And
it's a big jump.
It's a huge jump. I mean, the airplane that I was flying took off at the same speeds that, or cruised at
the same speeds as the 7.2.
The 7.2.
Took off and landed at.
Yeah. So anyhow, I got on with them and kept in touch with a gentleman that I met that was a captain for an airline called Wiener Alaska. And I never thought I'd ever really hear from him again, but I actually met him the day before we were going to start what they call basic indoctrination at the airline that flew freight. And anyhow, down the road a piece, he called me and he said, how would you like a job? And I gave that freight company a 1 week's notice.
See ya.
With the hopes that I wouldn't, get fired before I got hired.
Right,
up
right.
Up into Wiener, Alaska.
Yeah, because that'd be bad. Kidding.
And my interview included smoked salmon. So if I, yeah. If
you had
I,
to like smoked
I had
salmon.
A, I had to like, so I didn't care if I hated it.
You're going to eat it.
I was going to eat it.
You show up an interview, you do almost anything.
So,
depending on how bad you want the job.
Yeah, exactly. So I got through that and got hired and got furloughed from there, and then you know, got hired by two airlines in the after I got furloughed after interviewing. One of those airlines was American Airlines, and 34 years later,
here you are.
Here I am.
And so you took that certificate and went there on the 20th anniversary of the certificate.
I did. Yeah. And I got a pseudo interview.
But still, they honored it, even if it was just a pseudo interview. It
took a little pushing, but yes.
Right. Well, that's okay, but it worked. There's that perseverance again. It worked, and it kept you in their minds.
True.
So when the time came to actually interview with them again, you could actually say, hey, by the way, I've done this once before here, and this is why.
Right.
You took that certificate to the interview, to the real interview.
I actually took that certificate, put it in all my applications that I would send every month practically.
Right.
And they had a procedure with what they call a board of captains. So it was current captains and retired captains that would talk to you, you know, about your career and about you. And it turns out that one of those retired captains recognized the signature on that certificate. And he said, I flew with that captain. And I thought, I got a good chance of getting hired.
You know, and I'm sure there was a small, I mean, there's so many different aspects of getting hired at an airline. There's so many things they look at. And if one little thing stands out above the other guy,
right,
that might be just enough to get you the job and not him. And I'm willing to bet that part of that was that certificate. And your perseverance again. Like a kid got this at 6, now he's here again at 26. We got to hire him because he really, really wants to be here.
Well, nobody,
and they want to hire people that want to be there.
Nobody was going to recommend me, you know, so I had to find some other way.
Recommend yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, they say got a letter of recommendation. Rarely does it say, well, I guess they do. So nowadays, it's a little different, but yeah, just write, bring me a letter of recommendation. Here's my letter of recommendation. Isn't that you? You said letter of recommendation. I'm recommending myself.
Yeah, right. But that's it. That's sort of the short story. Is there anything else you want to add to your story?
No. I mean, it was fun. I still haven't landed on that beach. That beach, and you know I did own a Cessna 180, so that time might have passed. That beach is still on my lock screen of my phone. So it reminds me every day of how I got to where I am.
That's right.
And I'm excited. Yeah, I mean, I got to see parts of the world that I'll never see at my current airline. I got to meet people I'll never meet at my current airline. It was a great experience. I wouldn't change it for anything.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Sounds like yours.
Well, I had one experience in the process of not being employed, and that was selling used Toyotas in a Seattle dealership and asked me how good I was at that.
I've been to Seattle, and I've seen some Toyota stores up there, but I don't think I've ever seen Les Ovens Toyota.
No, I was. I think I was hidden in the back.
So you.
Every time somebody would walk in, potential customer, they'd go, "We got this," and rightfully so.
So not so good.
Not so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it had a happy ending. Then
clearly, so you are.
Yeah. Here I am.
So automotive industry. I was in the automotive industry too.
Right.
A little different aspect of it, but yeah.
Yeah.
And it was fun. Of course, then again, I like cars, a lot. Almost as much as I like airplanes.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anything else?
No.
All right.
Let's move on. Once again, we have a favor to ask. Invite your friends to the Candid Cockpit podcast, you know?
And please consider sending an email with a question or a topic that you'd like discussed, and send it to candidcockpit.com, and we'll mention your name on air with your permission, of course.
Mike Strauss. Oh, I have to give you a topic.
Topic.
Finally, say hello to your pilots next time you board an airplane, and tell them you listen to Candid Cockpit, and ask them if they do, and if they say no, say you should. So, onto our landing segment. Apropos. Let's talk about landing.
Landing a big jet. Yeah. I think that's a question that we get from passengers. Is it hard to fly an airplane, but is it hard to land an airplane? What's the hardest part, takeoff, landing? I guess landing has a lot more involved with it, and I guess maybe that's what people maybe have concerns about.
Right. you know, as just due to natural aerodynamics, taking off is simple. The airplane will fly itself off the ground at some point.
Yes.
But
that's optional. Takeoff is always optional.
Takeoff is always optional. Correct. That's part of our training. Yes. Takeoff is optional. Landing, yeah.
It's mandatory.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and it's different. It requires a little bit. I mean, not that takeoff requires any less attention to detail of what you're doing, but landing maybe sort of better for lack of a better term, maybe it's a little more critical. And it's also where we have a chance to show off our piloting skills.
Smooth touchdown, right? I mean, that's a big deal. He's a great pilot if he or she can
put a greaser on it. Not knowing that you've touched down.
Yeah.
Tap the gun exit. Hey, by the way, we're on the ground. Pull up the ground spoilers.
And you know what? We're competitive about it among ourselves. You know, passengers love it when you do the grease job thing. But at the end of the day, you know, everybody skips that part between the takeoff.
Right.
And the cruise, and the fact that you might have been deviating around weather, and all the decision processes
that took place in between.
In between, plus the approach, and, you know, was it bad weather, was it crosswind? So there's stuff in between, but people judge you by that last 5 feet.
Only as good as your last landing, exactly. And it will get remembered.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. You know, what's it like? I mean, what's the difference between a landing this,
right,
or landing the arrow?
And Mike's pointing at what are we pointing? Oh, you're pointing.
I'm pointing at your
777 model.
Okay. Model, which model. Is the size of a building.
Yeah, pretty much.
And then the your personal aircraft, the Piper Arrow, which is the size of the elevator of the building.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, it's the same principle. It really is. You know, we're coming down at a descent at a consistent descent angle rate, and angle. And the idea is just before you get to the ground, you arrest that descent with what's called a flare. And it's just lightly or maybe a little bit heavier pull on the control yoke. That goes back to our flight control segment, or what will come in our flight control segment. And then you just kind of just arrest that descent and put the airplane smoothly on the runway. Big airplane, little plane, it's the same. But the technique for a big airplane, or the assistance we have from the big airplane, ground proximity warning system, radar altimeter, compared to that in a light airplane, is different.
Yeah, and so in general terms, what do those systems do for?
So a radar altimeter, which we typically don't have in our small airplanes, but most jets do, almost all jets do, it is kind of what it sounds. It sends a radar signal from the bottom of the aircraft to the ground and back up. And it has a measurement. It will measure how far you're away from the ground. And it measures from the main landing gear, since that's the first part of the airplane you'd like to touch the runway. So you're getting some assistance. Our call-outs start at 100 feet, then they go to 50, 40, 30, 20, 10. So you have a really good idea. Because, again, you know, the airplane's coming in at a high angle of attack. Nose up. Pitch.
Nose up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're not trying not to be techie. So nose right. up attitude to land. So where the wheels may be 10 feet off the ground, you're 50 feet off the ground. And it's hard to judge exactly where the wheels are compared to where you are. But so you get some assistance. But there's still a lot of your own skill in that, because, you know, where you're looking at the runway, a sight picture, and that sight picture can change with weather, with wind, the environment around that particular airport. So there's a lot of factors, but that's, again, where the radar altimeter will help you.
And that comes with proficiency and experience with that particular airplane. And while you were explaining that radio altimeter situation where it measures the height above the ground.
Correct.
That's what's important to know the difference between that and a regular, what we call a barometric altimeter. Mm-hmm. But where you were saying we actually have a electronic voice. Some are female, some are male, depending upon the airline, what they select.
Yeah, that's true.
And they start at 100, go to 50, and then you went 50, 40, 30, 30, 20, 10. If that electronic voice was saying it that fast.
Yeah, you're in trouble. It's not going to be a smooth landing.
It's not going to be a smooth landing.
By the way, I had to learn French.
Oh, yeah, right.
I fly a French airplane.
French airplane, yeah. So.
But we don't have that assistance in the little airplane. But in the little airplane, you're a lot closer to the ground, so the cues, perhaps, are a little easier to read.
What you call the sight picture.
Yeah.
You know, it's very different. How far down the runway do you look for a specific airplane that you're flying? You know, every airplane's going to be a little different. And you know what? Your seat height makes a difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I'm vertically challenged. So I have to sit, you know, I have to raise my seat up. A little bit. You know, that makes a difference.
It does. You know, and there's one more little thing we haven't even discussed or even think about. In the aircraft, on the center post of the glare shield,
right,
there is one orange ball and two white balls.
Right.
And the idea is you use that guide, that tool, as a guide to set your seat, and then according to the engineers, that puts you in the best place to get the best visual out of the airplane, and yeah, specifically for landing and taking off.
That's why I never paid attention to it.
Didn't your airplane have auto land?
Well, there's that.
There's yeah, that.
Well, that's since you bring that up.
Yeah.
Who makes the, well, at least in the 777, you know, who makes the better landing, the pilot or the autopilot? And that, embarrassingly,
the autopilot does a pretty good job.
Does a really good job.
Airbus is so, the same way.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. The technology has advanced to that point, and we think that we're going to become obsolete, you know, because of that.
But hopefully not in my lifetime.
Yeah, hopefully not in my lifetime.
You know, back to Autoland, there are a couple of new general aviation manufacturers. Again, technology.
Yeah.
Piper and TBM, Dahar Sakata. They've got a, call it a return to base button. If, let's say, you as a pilot become incapacitated.
It's the spouse button.
Yeah, the spouse button. And the spouse can go, boom, and the airplane will do everything it needs to do to find the closest suitable airport.
Yep.
Land it, and I mean, right down to putting the gear down, the flaps down. The only thing it's not going to do is talk to air traffic control.
Correct.
You know, that brings up a good question. I wonder if it automatically sets the transponder.
I believe it does.
Okay.
And the transponder that Mike is talking about is a specific 4-digit code that air traffic control can see you on their radar.
Right. Yeah, you have it's a radio in the aircraft. You set a given code, and then the air traffic control knows who you are.
It's called a discrete code. Yeah.
And there's three emergency codes that we use. That way air traffic control would know that this is a situation. It will probably clear everybody out of your airspace. They'll kind of figure out where you're going.
Yeah.
That's coming to general aviation. It's amazing what we have in general aviation now as far as technology.
Well, even the airline doesn't have that. You just can't hit a button and you know, make it happen and land the airplane.
No, it's a procedure to set it up.
It'll put the gear down, the whole, everything. So it takes the place of a co-pilot. Don't give that too much thought.
No.
So you probably had an experience. What was it like? I had an interesting experience out in the middle of the desert, but you had an experience about landing a jet for the first time, or a big jet, anyhow.
727. Your magazine has played a part in this.
Flying Magazine.
Flying Magazine. Yeah. Len Morgan had written an article about how to land a 727 because it's just a little different than any other jet. And I had an opportunity to go fly right seat in a 727. And I had never flown a jet before. And I remembered that article. And I managed to do exactly what that article said. Was, you know, we talked about the arresting the descent right before you get to the runway. But then in the 727, because the main gears are so far back, if you continue to arrest it, you basically stand a chance of driving the mains into the ground a little harder than you're trying to. So Leonard said the trick was, just before you're going to touch down, roll it forward, push forward on the control column to lower the pitch, which kind of raises the back just a little bit or levels it out and just puts it on smoothly. And I did just that. And the guy I was flying with got mad at me because my first landing in the 727 was far better than his first landing, or second or third or fourth landing in the 727.
But you know, it all goes, and especially in the 727, it all goes downhill from there.
Of course.
It all goes downhill.
Well, and your first jet landing involved 727s as well.
It did. I was on the middle of the desert. I was working for that freight company I talked about earlier, and I was the last to go. There were two co-pilots who were upgrading the captain that were alternating seats, and we were doing stop and goes, essentially. And actually, we did touch and goes as well, believe it or not.
Really?
The runway was long enough.
Okay.
So we were doing that, and I was just, I was besides myself thinking, this is not going to work. I'm going to make a big smoking hole in the desert because my training was very abbreviated.
Right.
I felt I needed more, and I wasn't the ace of the base.
We always do.
Well, we always do, but I didn't feel I was quite the ace of the base, you know, when I got done with training. And here we are about to do this in this huge jet that I was going to potentially, you know,
create a crater in the desert.
Create a crater in the desert.
So and anyhow, these guys had experience too,
and they had an experience, and they were doing an awful job, an absolute awful job. They were just, you know, if you had dentures, you would have lost them on that. So it was my turn, and you know, I thought I had sweated everything out of my hands by then, and I managed to go around three times the pattern,
right,
and did a respectable job, even with one little grease job on one of the landings,
nice.
and that was a big relief.
You know, it's funny. Every landing in a jet is different. Every single one of them. It's so hard to duplicate the one you just did as much as you want to.
It's an art.
It is an art.
It is an art.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But it's fun, and it is. I think it's the greatest challenge that we do in the airplane.
It is. I mean, that's what I love to do.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was always a proponent of flying the airplane up to altitude, and then at least by 10,000 feet, I would click the autopilot off for landing,
right,
and just fly the jet. You know, it would scare my co-pilots.
So that it drives me. I do the same thing. I still do it to this day. And I, you know, they're like, "Well, when are you going to put the autopilot on?" Or, wait, why are you taking the autopilot off so high? Fly. I'm a pilot. Well,
right.
But the autopilot. Yeah. If you want to call me Otto, then call me Otto.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree.
They
yeah.
fly the same. I mean, they fly like an airplane.
Well, you and I enjoy flying. And
we do.
Some of these guys just want to get the job done, and they want to get it done efficiently. And I'm not saying we're not efficient when we fly the airplane, but it's what we did. It's what we signed up for.
It was our passion.
Yeah.
And there are people that fly for a living because it's a good living and good flexibility and good travel and stuff like that, where I like to think that most pilots fly because they love to fly. It's not just a job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of times you find that you're the one with the most passion in the airplane. And that's fine.
Yeah. I'm bothered by that.
A lot of the military folks that got on with a lot of experience and great experience, you know, for them, it's the airplane's parked at the gate and they're done.
Yeah.
You know, they don't fly airplanes when they get home. I mean, it's an expensive hobby, right?
It is.
But they have no interest in anything about the airline when they get home, anything about airplanes.
Or aviation in general.
And aviation in general. Yeah. So we do have them out there, but, you know.
We're not them.
We're not them.
I get to go fly today as soon as we're done with this.
That's right.
I'm going to go fly.
You can take your bonanza out of here.
I'm going to hope for a good greaser landing.
Yeah,
bonanza's pretty easy to fly and land.
But you'll be by yourself, so all you can do is lie.
I wouldn't lie to myself. Not much. Landing. Anything else?
No.
Call the landing segment a nice greaser?
Yeah, we'll call it a greaser. All right.
Awesome.
Well, Captain Mike, I think we've landed this episode.
And it was a nice greaser.
I guess it was, yeah. I hope our listeners gained some insight into our pilot brains and some of the things that we do behind the locked cockpit door.
Right.
We're really glad you climbed aboard. Next week, we'll be discussing pilot background experience. Who's the better pilot, the military or the civilian? Yeah.
That topic came up very briefly in our landing segment, military and civilian pilots.
We'll have some fun.
It'll be
with
a good conversation.
Yep.
Once again, as we start our parking checklist, just want to let us ask our listeners one more time, get on the PA and spread the word about our podcast to your friends, your family, and send us an email at candidcockpit.com. Let us know if you have a topic you'd like to discuss, and with your permission, we'll mention your name on there. Also, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and check out our website, Candid Camera. I did it, Candid Camera, candidcockpit.com.
And don't forget Instagram. And remember, don't get on an airplane until you've listened to Candid Cockpit. Till the next takeoff, have a safe flight. Thanks for coming with us.
Have a safe flight. Thanks for joining us.